This is Michael Kosky. I'm your volunteer reader for science fiction here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And that means it's time once again for this week's edition of Science Fiction Stories. I'll begin with a story from Marie Vibert. It's called Cheaper to Replace. Han tried not to look at the greasy fingerprints marking the seams on James's silicone skin. "How do you feel, James?"
"Dizzy."
He swung his legs against the workbench in perfect imitation of the teen he resembled.
"But not so much as before."
The IT guy mashed his hands in an oily towel. He had thick forearms and a purple skullcap. "I replaced the gyroscopic components, but that's not the source of the problem. His balance processing's all screwed up, and the gyros are getting banged around. Whatever I put in there is going to wear out just the same."
Han didn't like the IT guy.
"Well, can he learn to compensate?"
"Well, I don't know. You could hire a specialist to tweak his program. Don't think there are any out-of-the-box solutions available. He's too old. Honestly, I think the whole processing unit has to go. Otherwise, you're going to have a robot in a wheelchair inside of 2 months."
He raised his eyebrows at Han, expectant, like this was a door he was holding open for. Han thrust her arm between the IT guy and James. "Come on, we're going home."
"Hey, don't be like that. I did my best work on this kid. I'll tell you what, we'll buy him off you for the price of the parts. That's more than you'll get anywhere else. Give you something towards a new one, anyway."
"No, thank you." James took her hand and stood up slowly, not tugging like a real boy would. Han loved his gentleness, even though on an intellectual level, she knew he was a puppet controlled by libraries of commands. He was a rich family's unwanted toy, dumped on the university as a tax write-off. Han liked to think, though, that he had once been loved, the cherished caregiver to a lonely child, maybe, or a stand-in for never-visiting grandchildren. The IT guy's voice echoed after them in the basement hallway. "It'll be cheaper to replace him than to fix him. Anyone'll tell you that." A parking garage separated the biomedical research building from the School of Medicine's main building. When they were almost halfway across the yellow-hashed walk, the light at the entrance of the garage blacked out, followed by the scrape of metal on concrete and the roar of gasoline combustion. Han ducked behind James and prayed that Dr. Narayan was paying attention. It could only be Dr. Narayan. Dr. Narayan's legendary 1975 Ford LTD Brougham swung within a foot of them. Its blocky frame rocked like a ship, exposing the wheel wells as it turned into its special double-width parking spot, where it huffed like a wearied dragon and settled its sparkly brown carapace to rest. Han was shaking from the near miss. James hugged her.
"You're all right now," he said.
Some routine noticed the facial features of fear or the action of cringing and prompted his soothing words. Her heart broke for the nameless programmers. They didn't have to code that, but they did.
"The IT department was our last hope, James. Dr. Brescia doesn't want you back. I'm sorry."
His hair smelled like her old Barbie doll and clung to her wet cheek.
"That's okay."
A bang echoed through the underground lot, the heavy door of the LTD. Dr. Narayan strutted by, swinging her car keys on one finger.
"Get a room, kids," she said in passing.
Han stepped back from James and wiped her eyes.
She watched Dr. Narayan step through the door to the biomedical research building. Could Han ever be that confident, that assertive? We're just going to have to move you out of the lab. No, Gundo, the administrative assistant for the biochemistry department, didn't even look up from his screen. You guys are always dumping old lab equipment on me. In a week, you won't know how to get along without him. Han glanced at James, who straightened up in his chair and looked, she hoped, helpful and secretarial. Aren't you always saying you need more help? Gundo fell back in his chair, letting it swivel. I need a student who can run printing and scanning for our paper fetishizing faculty. Oh, James can do that. He learns anything by watching. Gundo rubbed his forehead. You won't regret this. Han jumped to her feet. I didn't say yes. James stood to follow her. Han held out her palm toward him. No, James, stay with Gundo. James took a step. I feel dizzy, he said. I think... And James fell forward. Han and Gundo both lurched toward him. He stumbled into the doorframe. There was a crack. Then he was down on his side on the carpet, waving a wedge of the wooden doorframe like a flag of surrender. Gundo stood, arms out as if to catch. He turned from the door to James and back. Han said, He has balance issues. It's not a big... Gundo collected himself. Out! Take it out of here, or I'll call security. Han had to duck under James's swinging elbows to try to help him up. He accidentally struck her, hard and heavy. Ow, James! I'm sorry. James had a note of panic in his voice. I must balance, and I can't. Just stop, James. Be still. He stopped, becoming stiff as a corpse. Han couldn't lift him, but she dragged him into the hall. Gundo watched without offering to help. When they were clear, he tried to close the door, but it wouldn't latch. Gundo tried again. He slammed the door hard, breaking more wood free. Like a curse, he muttered, Now I have to call facilities. Han got two other grad students to help her carry James into his storage closet. She thought he looked relieved when she finally turned him off. Han sat on the grimy curb in the parking garage. She heard the door behind her open and turned away from it, not wanting whoever it was to see her crying. Hey, a soft woman's voice. Han hunched her shoulders and hoped to turn invisible. Dr. Narayan sat on the curb next to her. She was wearing tan pants that would easily get dirty. Han said, I'm fine, and it came out sounding wet. Let me walk you to the counselor's office, Dr. Narayan said. Han shook her head. Dr. Narayan tugged her elbow upward. Han turned toward her. You drive that horrible car. Dr. Narayan straightened. Roberta isn't horrible. I mean, Dr. Narayan, you have to help me. They're going to sell him for parts. I know he's just a machine, but he's like my little brother, and they want to tear him up for money. Dr. Narayan's posture relaxed. Ah, you're Dr. Brescia's assistant. Oh, you have to know someone who can fix him. You make your antique car run. She shook her head. I'm sorry, kid, but cars aren't robots. It's not the same thing. But could your mechanic at least look at him? Dr. Narayan stood up and dusted her bottom. Look, if it don't bleed, it don't matter, right? James does matter. She couldn't put it in words, but there was something important in loving an object, putting your heart into the velveteen rabbit or piglet or this sweet doe-eyed silicon boy. Dr. Narayan gave her a long look. You're young. You need a couple more years before you can have expensive hobbies like mine. She took a backward step. Counselor's office is still open. She walked away, steps echoing in the wide, low parking garage. Online forums echoed the IT guy's opinion. It was cheaper to replace James than to fix him. 2 years ago, Han's sewing machine had seized up. It was only a year old. When she took it back to the store, they said it would be cheaper to replace it than fix it. Then she took it to an old junk shop near her apartment, and a little old man with gnarled hands and a thick Eastern accent had said, "Nah, is gear, you see?" He'd popped the case off her sewing machine and replaced a little plastic gear that had seized with a metal one. It took him barely a minute. "You see how they cheap with plastic? Bah, standard size, no charge, please, is pleasure, no charge." She bought him a cup of coffee to pay for the repair that was too expensive to make. Han was working on making this into a forum reply. Gundo poked his head into the lab. "Your toy is gone tomorrow." Han stopped typing and stood. "I can get him fixed." Gundo half shrugged. "You keep saying that. I have the equipment disposal paperwork all filled out, and if he's not doing something useful or gone by tomorrow, I'm filing it." Han followed him into the hall. "Why are you doing this?" "It's my job. Why are you so attached? You do know he's not alive, right?" The door to the administrative office was propped open for repair. When Gundo saw her looking, he raised his eyebrows at her, a silent threat. Han had done the unthinkable. She had pissed off a departmental admin. She'd heard horror stories, dissertations lost, grades removed from records. She had to find a way to make it up to Gundo, once she saved James. The junk shop was empty, its sign gone. Through the window, the space looked larger than she remembered, the counter bare. She could still see the drawer the old man had opened, full of little wooden compartments like the change drawer on a cash register. She waited on the stoop, hoping to see the old man if he lived nearby. A police officer walked by. Then he came back. "This isn't a safe neighborhood, miss. Do you know the repairman who used to have this shop here?" His face was unmoving. "You should go home." "Are there any other repair shops like this one was? Doesn't anyone fix things anymore?" "I'm not the person to ask about that." The cop looked apologetic, but his hands were on his gun belt. "There's no loitering here." Han wheeled a lab chair over to the storage closet. She held the chair with one foot, hooked behind a wheel, while she carefully tipped James forward onto it. The chair slipped away, and James dropped like a plank. The crash shook the whole floor. Han froze. No one came. She looked at the chair and back at James. She wasn't strong enough to pick him up. She crouched next to James and switched him on. James rolled onto his back and smiled at her. "Hello, Han. Just give me your hand. Steady, steady. Can you sit up?" "Okay, now stand." He listed sharply. "No, no, don't try to balance. Just straighten your legs out." With James's help, she got him onto the wheeled chair. Han was covered in sweat by the time they reached the elevator. Dr. Narayan opened her apartment door with one hand cradling her phone to her ear. Yeah. Hey, listen, can I call you back?" She stared at Han. "What are you doing here?" "I'm sorry to bother you, Dr. Narayan. James is having trouble with your stairs." Dr. Narayan leaned to peer down the apartment stairs. James stood at the bottom, dutifully circling one leg up and back, caught in an endless loop of starting to climb, then being told he was off balance, regaining, starting to climb again. Dr. Narion leaned back. How did you get through the security door? Oh, please help us, Dr. Narion. I promise I didn't break anything. Her glare was leveling, adult, firm. Tell me, or I call the cops. James tried to step again and again. Hans sighed. I found a hack for your lock online. What? Dr. Narion ran a hand through her hair. She started to move away, then stopped, jabbing a finger at her. I'll tell your PI. Oh, no, please don't. I also uploaded the patch so it won't work again. See? I'm helping your security. You just... And Dr. Narion closed her eyes. I can't begin to unpack all that's wrong with you. But she grinned like that had been a compliment and opened her door wider. Okay, I'll look at the beast. Let's get him up here. Dr. Narion's dining room table was covered in printed schematics and tools. Some strange mechanical thing stood at the end, like a pillar of cast metal with a fan on top. It looked heavy. Dr. Narion set it on a chair before helping Han hoist James onto the table. Thank you for seeing me, Doctor, James said. He calls the mechanic Doctor, Han explained. James, this really is a doctor. Cute, Dr. Narion rubbed her chin. James, can you follow my finger with your eyes? And she passed her hand in front of James and watched his eyeballs track. She bit her lip. I have no idea if that tells me anything. Dr. Narion stared at James as though his programming were written on the glass surface of his eyes. He's got a university equipment tag. She tapped the QR code pinned to his shirt. The school knows you brought him here, right? Han tried to force herself to say yes, but she wasn't very good at lying. When more time passed than was natural, Dr. Narion said, I see. Takes a lot of paperwork to throw anything out. If I bring him back working, everyone will be happy. They're throwing him out. Han felt a tremble in her fists and forced herself to loosen them. Yes, tomorrow, Gundo said. Dr. Narion tapped her lip. So the problem is his balance process. Yeah, she shrugged. Let's try taking it out. Can you do that? Sometimes a system can be bypassed. People used to remove their catalytic converters so they could use leaded gas. He won't be able to tell if he's balanced, but these things have a lot of processing power. We can program him to work around it, like he reacts to your emotional needs without any of his own. Han didn't like the significant look Dr. Narion gave her. It's not about needs. I customized his reactions to make him more fun to work with. It was a software bundle, actually, RoboQuirks 3.2, but she didn't want Dr. Narion thinking she was just some script kitty. James said, I'm sorry to be so much trouble. He looked like he was trying to gauge her reaction, like he was worried and wanted her approval. And wasn't that worth a measure of self-delusion? Didn't everyone pretend that fake emotions were real, that the people they worked with were their friends, that they were happy to see them, that they had a nice day? I know it's just programming, Han said. Customization can ruin a machine. Dr. Narion tapped her lip. Have you tried removing the customization code? But that's his personality. Dr. Narion seemed to study the back of Han's soul. Do you have any real friends? Han had to look away. I mean, we could comment it out for a test if the first thing doesn't work. Dr. Narayan's phone buzzed in her pocket. She pulled it out and looked at it. All right, let's give this a shot. She pressed her screen twice and then set the phone down next to James. Han expected Dr. Narayan to open James, but instead she got a cable and plugged her phone into him. She frowned at her screen. Han tried to read the frown. The frown deepened. Then a grin broke across Dr. Narayan's features. She waggled her finger over the phone screen. Look, see? The motor control doesn't know any better. We replace this routine with a line that says, yep, you're good. This is pure hatchet hacking. I wish my protein folding program was this simple. And, okay, let's test that. Han helped James down from the table. Dr. Narayan stood next to him, holding her phone close to the jack, the cable sagging. James fell on his face. Or not. Dr. Narayan jerked her phone back to save it from following him. Han rolled up her sleeves and squatted to lift James's shoulders. Don't worry, I'll get him. But he was so heavy. Dr. Narayan clucked her tongue and took hold of James. She was strong. Easily, she got him back on the table. She stepped back while they both caught their breath. This was it. This was where she would say it was too much work and it was over. Han would be so alone without James. Her days and weeks were peopleless. Work, computer, read, work. For the first time, she saw how untethered she was. Dr. Narayan plugged her phone back into James and frowned at her screen, her fingers making quick, subtle motions. When Ford sold my car, they expected her to last 7 years. Did you know that? Companies call it planned obsolescence. Your James was only intended to last 2 years, if that. But he still works. He was obsolete when the lab got him, and he's lasted years longer. Well, even companies don't always get what they want. There was something grim in Dr. Narayan's frown as she worked. She unplugged the phone this time before saying, "Okay, let's try that." James slipped down from the table himself and walked carefully, like an old man, his arms out at his sides. He looked perplexed. Han hovered near him, ready to try and catch him. "How do you feel, James?" James looked at his feet. "I feel weird, Han. I'm not dizzy, but I don't feel balanced either." He looked at her, eyes wide. "Will this be fixed?" Dr. Narayan tugged his loose shirt to rights. "He'll never pirouette again, but he should be able to walk." Han held James's hands and studied his glassy eyes. He gave her a small, half-embarrassed smile. She hugged him. Dr. Narayan's phone buzzed again, but she ignored it. "My LTD spent decades as junk, sitting in a barn in Tennessee. She's got factory paint and a solid frame, but that's all she had when I found her. So, yeah, you were right to come to me. I get it, loving a machine." "Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Narayan." Dr. Narayan shrugged her way out of Han's attempted hug. "Get out of here. And next time he breaks, buy him instead of stealing him." The phone buzzed. This time Han asked, "Who keeps calling?" Dr. Narayan rolled her eyes, and Han thought she wouldn't answer, but then she said, "My kid. She lives with her dad and calls me whenever they fight. It sucks. My ex is usually right, but what am I supposed to say?" I'm sorry?" Dr. Narayan shrugged. "My ex said it was the car or him." The statement left an awkward, heavy silence. Dr. Narayan opened the door and gestured for them to leave. Han felt awkward, unable to come up with a response to Dr. Narayan's personal revelation, and it was kind of her that she stayed by the door as they left, watching in case James fell. He didn't. He made it all the way to the bottom. Leaning against the door frame, Dr. Narayan called down, "If I had to do it over, I wouldn't have chosen the car." She closed the door gently, but it still felt like a rebuke. Han took James to the bus stop, where she paid for an extra ticket. "You're all right now," James said, and squeezed her hand, exactly the way she knew he would. A programmed response, like writing herself an affirming note. Han returned the hand squeeze. "What if I can't let go of you when I graduate?" James tilted his head. "You're going away?" "Yeah, in 2 or 3 years, if I finish my dissertation." "Don't go," he said. The bus arrived. His grip on her hand felt too strong. She looked down at it, and he let go. His expression turned cheerful, eager even. "Are we going home?" "Yes, James. Show me how good you can walk to your seat on the bus." And he did. Han followed, feeling the echo of that door closing. She let the space between them widen to feel what it felt like. And the name of that story was Cheaper to Replace. It was written by Marie Vibert. And you're tuned to Science Fiction Stories right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And our final story on today's program, Through These Moments Darkly, written by Samantha Murray. The portals have always been there, at least theoretically. You are a molecular biologist, not a physicist, so you only know about this because Li Jiayi used to talk on and on about them in a voice both soft and fiercely intent at the same time. You look towards the corner of your empty little apartment, and you can almost see her sitting on the window seat, delineated against the muted yellowish light from outside, shining through the dark clouds and the flurries of snow, her hand in her hair, talking again about how there could be portals, quantum and minuscule, riddled through everything. You can almost see her, still talking, her dark eyes shining here in your apartment right now, superimposed on this moment, the moment without her in it. When people are old or nearing the end of their time, according to various studies Jiayi has read, they look back on their life and apply a narrative structure, shaping form and meaning from the disparate strands and gathered collected experiences. Their lives become a story when they recall it retrospectively. You and Jiayi talk about this, throwing your words back and forth as she plays idly with your fingers. Her hands are much smaller than yours. What kind of story do you think your life will be when you're old looking back on it? Your tone is light and whimsical, but you are wondering with a small part of your mind whether Jiayi's story and yours will twist around each other going forwards, entwining like her fingers with yours. You can't imagine her old, though. It seems an impossibility. She's vibrant and so beautiful, and her life is in front of her, not behind. "Horror," Jiayi says matter-of-factly, and makes a claw out of her other hand, baring her teeth at you. "And you'd be slapstick, I think," she adds, considering. It's true that you are clumsy and forgetful, sometimes goofily, amusingly so. You both get the giggles after that, so perhaps you are both in a comedy instead. If you were old and looking back on your life, here are some of the moments you would try and piece together, knitting them, perhaps, into something coherent and whole, something that might make up whatever your story ends up being. 1. "I like my coffee the way I like my physics," Jiayi says to you the first morning she stays over and wakes up in your apartment. She's curled up in a T-shirt under the comforter, her hair messy, and out of the kitchen window you can see flakes of snow drifting down. You pause in your little kitchenette and look at her for a moment before you realize the answer. Dark. "I'm a physicist," she would say when introducing herself to new people, and then add her usual caveat, "a dark physicist." Current visible physics cannot explain the sapping of the effect of gravity or the rate of expansion of the universe. Li Jiayi has told you this on your very first date with a gravity of her own, her eyes deep and shadowed so that they look almost black. There are hypothetical dark particles that we can feel the effects of but can't interact with. You're fascinated and intrigued by both what she is saying and by Jiayi herself. Feel the effects of but can't interact with. You can feel the effects of her intelligence and her enthusiasm, and of the way she impatiently flicks her hair back out of her face as she talks. But you realize you want very much to interact with her, and you reach down to hold her hand. 2. Meeting Jiayi at the university in a poetry class you are sitting in on. She shows you a scrawled line of poetry in her notebook. This moment, frozen at the point of tipping. There are a lot of poems written about winter in this class, which is not surprising. Winter. Always winter. "I was just curious," Jiayi tells you later when she confesses that her heart belongs to physics, not poetry. This is one of the first things she says to you, and it turns out to be the word that defines her most exactly. Curious. Her agile mind is quick to seize an idea and tussle it to the ground. She loves to argue any point of mathematics or logic, and she scribbles down equations furiously, which seems akin to arguing, only with numbers and paper instead of with words. And she talks. She talks and talks and talks. Sometimes it's hard to keep up with her. These are some of the other words that stick to her, too. Talkative, impulsive, headstrong, playful. "For fun," you say when Jiayi asks you in turn why you chose to attend the class, but you are aware as you say it that that's not really it at all. "There's something in the poems that I'm looking for, maybe," you add hesitantly, trying to pare back to something honest. You don't want the first thing you say to her to not be true. "And maybe that is it." You feel a chill sometimes that seems to go bone deep when you're alone, even inside your heated apartment. A chill that is because it is winter. Always winter. But also isn't really to do with the temperature at all, but some other thing, some combination of memory, regret, and loss. You miss the sun on your skin and all the multi-hued flowers that used to line the avenue that leads to your apartment. You miss surfing and sweating and how good water tastes when you're hot. And maybe that is what you find in the poetry, an echo of this same pang running through and underneath the lines so often, that slender ache of longing. Even the language is changing, which it always does, of course. But it feels like new words are being spawned and used as you watch at a startling rate. The linguistics of it is fascinating, how quickly it is evolving. But change can happen quickly, dramatically so sometimes. The world knows this now, in the way younger people speak and in the modern poems you find new words for graduations of winter, deep winter, midwinter, light winter. Words for all of the kinds of snow, and words for the gray, bleak, cold sky with the snow that refuses to fall. Words for exactly how cold you can be, the cold that makes the tip of your ears ache in the wind, the cold that pervades every part of you so that you feel like you'll never be warm again, the cold that is existential in nature, that you can feel even when physically you are warm. The new words flow through the language, like rapidly moving water from a melting glacier eddying through ice flow. always winter. The accelerated global warming of the first 30 years of the 21st century led to rapidly melting polar ice and increasingly high-altitude rainfall, and the resultant extra mass of fresh water into the ocean surface impeded the flow of the Gulf Stream. This meant the Gulf Stream no longer carried warm water north. Global warming, ironically, responsible for a tipping point the world rushed towards and then fell skidding down the other side. The climate tipping and flipping into this perpetual, unrelenting winter. Always winter. Jai's smile warms you, though. It always has from those very first days. And when you're with her, it feels like enough. 3. Jai shows you a video. She's always finding things, ideas and concepts, clips and excerpts and articles and videos, and wanting to show them to you. It's an old video, short and basic, a psychological study of human selectivity of attention and awareness. There are 3 or 4 people wearing white and a similar number wearing black. The video asks you to perform a simple task of counting the number of times the people dressed in white pass a ball between them. The players move, turn, and weave, throwing and flicking and bouncing the ball to each other in different ways, so while the task is simple enough, it requires you to concentrate and focus. 15, you tell Jai when she pauses the video. Correct, she says, which you knew, but her smile broadens into something light and teasing. But did you see the gorilla? What? You say, unsure of the joke. It is only when she rewinds the video and makes you watch it again that you see something that feels like it should have been obvious. Not long after you had started counting, someone, dressed in a black gorilla suit, enters the scene from stage left. Casually, unhurriedly, they walk into the middle of the frame, stop to face the camera, beat their chest, and dance a little with some breakdance-style moves before slowly moving out of the shot on the other side. Jai laughs at the look on your face. It's a psychological classic, she tells you. There are a bunch of variants, and more than half of the people who do it don't notice the gorilla. And she tugs on your hair and grins. You're not surprised that Jai knows about psychology, even with her devotion to physics, and all the long hours that she spends on it. After all, you met her in a poetry class. She reads widely and comprehensively. Her nimble mind is always finding new fascinations, going from topic to topic, like she is jumping from one stone in a pond to the next, lightly, delicately, and with an effortless, unself-conscious grace. We don't experience the world as it is, Jai says, and you recognize that perhaps this is the point of the little experiment with the unseen gorilla, hidden in plain sight. Our brains use shortcuts and a bag of tricks to interpret the reality around us. We take in detail from only a tiny subset of our visual world. We think we notice everything. She sounds wistful and suddenly much younger. Her smile is gone now. But we don't. We can't. The world as it is. You missed the gorilla. Your attention was elsewhere. It is easy to miss things you are not looking for. And your own reality is only a shade of the universe as it really is. How much is hidden, unknowing, unknowable. All of the darkly beautiful physics that Jai is driven to explore, to calculate, to predict, to try to understand. She has told you that there are portals that are little mathematical doorways that allow dark matter particles to interact with regular matter particles. She's told you that there may be universes invisible on Earth outside of the portals, which are visible inside the portals, and that dark matter is the shadow of the hidden universes. It would explain it all, why stars in the outer reaches of the galaxy move faster than expected. Dark matter sculpting the universe with its hidden gravitational hand. Sometimes you understand what she's saying. Sometimes you lose track of her words, and while she speaks about the interplay between dark matter and visible normal matter, you instead watch the interplay of light flickering over her face. You wonder sometimes about ideas that are beautiful and vigorous, but are still wrong nevertheless. Jai is passionate about the theories, but they are theories still, not known fact, or not yet. Unknown fact, maybe. We think we notice everything. You think you notice everything about Li Jai, the way the light hits her hair, her ideas that jump and twist, her many different smiles and the myriad of expressions that dance over her face, but perhaps you don't notice everything. Perhaps you can't. 4. The first discovery of a couple of odd little amphibious creatures as at first presumed to be some kind of unknown frog species. Small, protruding eyes, strangely undulating, permeable skin, soft, flailing, red, grabby feet that remind you of sea anemone. The fact that a new variety is found when many less well cold-adapted species are dying out and becoming endangered or extinct is enough to cause some initial excitement. However, they turn out not to be frogs at all. Their chirality is reversed, you tell Jai, a small tremor in your voice. Some molecules are chiral. You can't superimpose them on a mirror image, like our hands. They are a mirror image, so identical in that way, but you can't put one on top of another and have them match exactly. I know what chirality is, Jai says. And of course she does. She seems to know little bits of everything, and this is not surprising. We have chirality in physics, too. The spin of a particle has either left-handedness or right-handedness, depending on the direction of its spin. So, in biology, which way does it go? Which handedness do we have? With biomolecules, DNA and RNA are all right-handed, but amino acids and proteins are all left-handed, you say. Here, they all go that way. Yes, here. Here on this planet, here in the world as you know it. You and Jai stare at each other, your eyes mirroring each other's, wide, excited, tremulous. The world notices that things start going missing. Certain species of birds have their populations decimated. A tracked colony of emperor penguins vanishes, and then the southern resident community pod of orcas disappears. The rapid changes to the climate have precipitated extinctions of flora and fauna, with other species becoming endangered, but not like this, not so very sudden. They are there, and then they're gone. You remember talking about orcas with Jai one evening while drinking sour cherry cider and watching pretty, gentle snowflakes drift down outside. There would be a new word for that kind of snow, but you can't think of it right now. Perhaps it was even this particular colony of orcas. You're not sure. Orcas are known for being highly intelligent and social. And there was a pod of orcas who, decades ago, before the climate changed so quickly and precipitously, developed a fad of wearing salmon hats. One particular bold or popular orca started the trend, and it quickly spread to her pod and two others. And for a season, many of the orcas in that region paraded around with salmon as hats. The trend died out as quickly as it had come, although a few years ago there was a short-lived resurgence where a handful of orcas restarted the habit after all that time. You and Jai had wondered if it was nostalgia-driven, if an old-time orca had remembered their halcyon days of swimming around in the ocean feeling glamorous, wearing a salmon hat, and tried to bring the fashion back again, or whether a young orca had the idea independently, an example of the spontaneous spread of new habits or knowledge in animal species. Jai had been captivated by the orcas. You wonder if these are the same ones that have vanished off the face of the earth, and if they are, you hope that they got to take their hats. I know what this is, Jai tells you, her voice hushed and brimming with something you can't quite identify. The new frogs that are not frogs, with reversed chirality. The animals and birds disappearing. It all fits, she says. Quantum portals have been there all along, according to the theories Jai works with, at least. Tiny mathematical doorways. And larger portals, portals a frog that is not a frog could fit through, or a person, or an orca, are not logically inconsistent, just wildly and absurdly impractical. Where would we get the energy from, you ask Jai. It shouldn't be possible, surely, it couldn't be. She shakes her head. We can't. The energy requirements would be too overwhelmingly massive, even to create the tiny portals. We don't have enough, even if we had better technology in the future. Nowhere near enough. Well, then, how? It would have to be coming from the other side, she says. The energy. The other side? Dark matter is the shadow of the hidden universes. Universes invisible on Earth outside of the portals, which are visible inside the portals. The other universe, she tells you. You think again about how ideas can be beautiful and logically consistent and still turn out to be wrong. For a physicist who deals with quantum uncertainty, Jai seems very certain. Jai is not wrong. Reports of portals start coming in from all around the planet, oval-shaped, spinning, appearing only briefly, varying from those the size of a mouse to those the size of a truck, rare, transient, elusive. People record them on their phones. There's a waviness to the air around it. The picture looks blurred, poor quality, like a fake image almost. People riot, join cults, pray, commit suicide, make social media posts, go about their lives. Some try to chase the portals, claiming they are a passage to a new world, but the portals do not stay and cannot be predicted. A national body to investigate the phenomena is formed. Li Jai and her team studying dark matter and portal physics are front and center. Your group studying the not-frogs are brought in. It occurs to you that you and Jai would have met here, now, brought together into the same team to study the portals, if you hadn't met 3 years ago in a poetry class. Jai is single-minded and driven, staying up late, her hair pulled back, dark circles under her eyes. She is almost frantic, because the portals don't persist long enough for her team to get even close to one. 5. Li Jai goes missing. No one hears from her. She does not come home. There and then gone. Jai, with her vim and her alert gaze and her nature, changeable like the sea in a storm. Jai, your Jai. Or at least you'd thought so. I know what this is, you think, clutching the thought to you like a blanket, aware you are echoing words Jai said to you. I know what this is. You talk to her family over the phone. You fill out a police report. We've had a lot of missing people reported recently, the police officer says. Her eyes are kind, but not, you think, hopeful. Time without Jai, but still defined by her, by the shape of her absence, by memory and longing, and a deep, abiding, aching coldness at your core. I know what this is. Jai was always running towards something, always seeking, never happy than when she was on the brink of something new. If Jai found her portal, you wonder whether she stopped to think of you, hesitated, glanced backwards. You'd like to think so, but you can't quite see it in the picture in your mind. In the picture, she steps forwards eagerly with a kind of joy. The words that define her, curious, impulsive. She would go, You know that as well as you know her. Not away, but towards. Not away from you, from Earth, from everything she'd ever known or cared for, but towards. Towards the unknown, the unanswered questions. The drive to explore, to see, to know, is stronger in her than any other drive, including love. Most of the birds have disappeared. The skies are quiet and bare. You avoid thinking of the other reasons, darker reasons, to explain where Jai might have gone, what might have happened. You start feeling like things are slipping away when you're not looking, and if you turn around fast enough that you might catch them going. Little things, teaspoons and books and pencils and coffee. Coffee dark, like her physics. You've always been clumsy, forgetful. Maybe that is why you keep losing things. Losing things. Perhaps it is your mind, your sanity that is slipping away when you're not looking. You wish you could cry, but your heart is frozen solid in your chest. Always winter. And now, without her, only winter. 6. You see it, in the corner of your empty apartment. It is not there, but now it is. It may be gone again in any moment. You can feel a slight pulling to the air, like the puckering of a balloon when it is starting to deflate, or the tips of your fingers after too long in the hot bath. There's a smell, very faint, but you're sure it's there, that reminds you of ozone, of petrichor, of grass freshly cut. You remember Jai talking about the energy required. From the other side, she said. Why, you asked. Why now? What changed? I don't know, she had said. We have no way of knowing what anything is like over there. It could be chance, coincidence, timing, or perhaps some kind of invitation. Ideas can be beautiful and logically consistent and still turn out to be wrong. But here it is, right in front of you, like an invitation, like a choice, frozen at the point of tipping. Will all these separate events and moments really turn into a story when you look back on them? Even if you get to look back on your life one day, if you look back on it now. Like Jai's story is one of adventure and exploration and discovery. You know this with your own certainty. But you have been in a love story this whole time, and Jai is all of it, the story, the entire poem, the ebb and flow and the spaces in between, the last line that ties it all together. Winter, always winter. You say her name under your breath, and you step into spring. And the name of that story was Through These Moments Darkly, and it was written by Samantha Murray. My name is Michael Kosky, and I'm your volunteer reader for science fiction here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'd like to thank you for joining me today. Please stay tuned for more great programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.